The two things we really zero in on people are, you know, two things. They sound simple, they end up being very difficult. Courage and genius. Courage is the one we talk about a lot because it's the one that people can learn. You know, courage, which is to say not giving up in the face of adversity, you know, just being absolutely determined to succeed, you know, is something that you can like force yourself to do. It can be very painful. You can force yourself to do it. The genius part is a little bit hard to force yourself to do. You know, courage without genius might not get you where you need to go, but genius without courage almost certainly won't.
That is the voice of American entrepreneur, Mark Andreessen. And he'll be giving us 7 super tips on today's Super You podcast.
It's one small step for man.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
We choose to go to the moon, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
I have a dream.
You can't handle the truth.
7.
6.
5.
4.
3.
2.
1.
Super
You. Welcome to the show. Welcome to the Super You podcast. This is your host, Eric Quammen. Most of you know me as Equalman. I thought I'd start off with a story about Mrs. Libby. I'm sure a lot of you this week, or maybe it was even today, had a tough time getting out of bed. And we all have those days. I've had one recently. And when we have those days, a lot of times we want to just crawl back under the covers because what we're thinking about is, what am I here for? What am I going to do today? Or more specifically, sometimes, what do I have to do today? If you flip the what into who, it's super helpful for me and it's helped thousands of people to where you flip it and go, don't ask yourself, what am I here for? But who am I here for? And that who can be anyone. It can be even a pet. Like, who are you here for today? Could even be for an enemy. But the reason I brought up Mrs. Libby, so growing up in Michigan, our next door neighbors were the Libbys, and their kids were long gone, and they were older, and then Mrs. Libby became a widow, but they needed someone to cut their lawn. And so here I am, 12 years old, happy to cut their lawn. Now, normally I'd get paid about $15, $20 to cut a lawn the size of theirs. And theirs was quite tricky. It was on a hill. So maybe even $25 or $30. Because it'd take a couple hours. But Mrs. Libby would pay me $5. And there's definitely days where I would go, oh, I might even complain to my parents, like, do I have to go cut Mrs. Libby's lawn? But every time I did it, I always felt better when I was done. So Mrs. Libby, she'd actually stay out there and help me bag the grass. So she was old, you know, she was just leaning against her walker and sweet lady. And we'd talk a little bit in between when we, you know, the bag would fill up with the grass and then I'd have to unclip it from the lawnmower, then walk it over to the bin and she'd hold the bag open, the garbage bag, and I'd pour the clippings in there and we'd just talk a little bit about life. And then she'd just get a smile on her face and continue to cut the lawn on that horrible hill that I was sweating to death. It was so hot sometimes in the summer cutting it, but it was $5. And again, probably get $30 for that type of lawn, but it was worth it. And that was the who. And I often look back at that when I'm having a tough time getting out in the morning, I realize that it's really about the who are we going to help? And that's why you're listening here today, because all of you are trying to unlock that superpower within all of us so we can help people. So you want to unlock that superpower, unleash it on the world. And so I hope you're getting a lot of these Super You podcasts. We're having fun with them. Definitely keep sending in those DMs. Send in the email to me, equalman@equalman.com. And we'll make sure we get what you need because we want to help you out there. Because part of you as listeners, you're our who. And hopefully you also help us. So understand when you send those kind notes in, when you post those ratings and reviews, you're helping me out too. So it's a great, great world we live in, but there's days when we just don't want to get out of that bed and it's understandable. So hopefully that helps you out. Just flip your mindset from what do I have to do today to who am I going to help today? Who am I here for? Might be kids or it might just be your Mrs. Libby. So in that vein, my hope is these tips today help you out. They're going to come from Mark Andreessen. He's an American entrepreneur, investor, and software engineer. He's the co-founder of Mosaic, which was the first widely used web browser. And he also co-founded Netscape. So for those who are familiar with Netscape, also a browser. But most importantly, right now, he's a general partner at Silicon Valley venture capital firm Andreessen Horowitz. He's inducted in the first international conference on the World Wide Web. And the World Wide Web Hall of Fame. I didn't even know that existed. World Wide Web Hall of Fame. So I need to kind of apply for that. But he sits on the board of directors at Facebook, which I know all of you have heard about Facebook. So here we are with tip number one.
So there's a couple of big things. So just in terms of thinking about what we've been through in the last 20 years in Silicon Valley, some people in the room are old enough, you may remember there was a bubble, and it was a fairly big deal in sort of 1998 to 2000, and there was a very profound crash, which was deeply traumatizing for those of us who went through it. And then we've been through this extremely long period of basically, you know, actually years of pain followed by then sort of what I think of as very slow recovery. I think it's actually been an object lesson in the psychology of markets and bubbles. I think that people are much more highly sensitized to bubbles after a bubble. If you could be sensitized to them before a bubble, you could make a lot more money. But people get highly sensitized. And so there's this phenomenon of trying to close the barn door after the horses have escaped. And that is a lot of what all the bubble talk in the last 10 years has been about. So we could talk at length about kind of why I think, in fact, tech is not now in a bubble and has not been in a bubble since 2000. The deeper thing, the more interesting thing is this follows a historical pattern, which is what I talked about at the Goldman conference, which is based on the best thinker on this topic is an economist named Carlotta Perez, who wrote a book called Technological Revolutions. That's probably the single best book. Like that book and The Innovator's Dilemma are probably the two key books that are really critical to understanding how this industry works. And so she describes in her book, she describes a general model for the deployment of new technologies and then how technologies intersect with financial markets. And so she's got this whole thing, and it's basically this multi-generational process. And there's basically these two big phases of it. There's what's called the installation phase, and there's what's called the deployment phase. And it turns out in every single case, and this includes railroads and like lots of electricity and steam engines and lots of prior new fundamental technologies, there's always this just gigantic bubble and then crash kind of halfway through. And historically, that marks the transition from the installation phase to the deployment stage. The deployment stage, you could argue, is where all the actual interesting things happen. It's where all the new technologies actually start to work. They actually make it into everybody's hands. They actually become cost effective, and we actually find out how to actually use all these things. And so that's the phase I think we're in now. You know, without talking about the WhatsApp deal in particular, it is interesting to note that the companies that people think are overvalued today generally either have billions of dollars of revenue. Which was not the case in the 90s. For example, Facebook. People argue Facebook as an example. Facebook went from zero to $10 billion of revenue in less than 10 years, and so that is definitely not what happened in the 90s. The other thing is the companies that people debate today, for the most part, have extraordinarily high customer count, user count. Market sizes have expanded gigantically, and so you've got these things now that people are arguing about that have, in some cases, a half billion users on their way to a billion users. And if people want to take a position that you can have a large-scaled internet service that's worth a billion users that's not going to be worth anything, you could take that position. I'm not sure I would recommend it.
So Andreessen was born in Cedar Falls, Iowa, and raised in New Lisbon, Wisconsin, on Wisconsin. And he's the son of Patricia and Lowell Andreessen, who worked for a seed company. And then in December 1993, he received his bachelor's degree in computer science from the University of Illinois. So go Big Ten. Go fight in the Illini. As an undergraduate, he interned twice at IBM here in Austin, Texas. So go Austin, Texas. But here he is with tip number two.
We started our second company, LoudCloud, in September 1999, and it was classic. You know, it was fantastic. It was incredibly high, rapid growth rate off of a standing start, straight into the last 6 months of the bubble. Unprecedented growth, cover of Wired magazine, on and on and on. We took it public in 18 months, and then just the world caved in, our entire business caved in, burning, you know, an enormous amount of cash because we had created the company for much, much higher growth. And our stock ultimately bottomed out at half of cash. So our shareholders made the judgment that not only were we so incompetent that we were not capable of justifying the amount of cash we had in the bank, but that we were certain to burn at least half of it before we would call it quits and just give them the cash back. Those were probably the dark days. And then, you know, NASDAQ, you know, starts sending the delisting letters, and they send about one a day, saying if you don't give your stock back up above a dollar, we're going to delist you and you'll be on the pink sheets. And we came within days from that. And so gutting through that, and by the way, gutting through that kind of thing at the same time that it looks like the entire world is ending, that it looks like, you know, the tech industry will never, ever recover. I think we the thing that we're most proud of is actually working our way through that.
Moving along to tip number three, Netscape was acquired in 1999 for $4.3 billion by AOL. And Andreessen's hiring as its chief technology officer was contingent on the completion of the acquisition. All right, here we are, tip number three.
Well, so the general criteria for a successful high-tech startup, in my view, you see different sort of rules of thumb from different people, but the three big things you always come back to are, is there a big market? And by the way, that comes in two parts. Is there a big existing market that you think you can go after and sort of displace incumbents, or or do you believe there will be a new market that will be big? So big market. Is there a fundamental technology or economic change that causes you to basically justify having a new company? And that's really important. And the way I always think about that is there a 10x change happening in the technology landscape? Is something 10x faster or 10x cheaper or 10x better? And if it's not 10x, we view as both VCs and entrepreneurs, we really have to ask ourselves, like, is it really worth doing? Because it's really hard. I mean, it's really hard to start new companies. Talking about macro theory, new companies generally shouldn't exist. Existing companies are usually pretty good at what they do. And so for a new company to exist, it not only has to go into business and bring a product to market, but it has to bring a product to market that's so much better than what already exists that it punches through the sort of status quo. Most customers in most markets are pretty happy buying from the current suppliers, and so there has to be a real kind of edge on the thing. And we look for that in either a technology change, usually a technology change, or an economic change, which are often the same thing. And then the third is team. Is the team outstanding? And if you think about this as an entrepreneur, it becomes a question of the founding team. Some companies are solo founders and they can work, but generally, most of us, like myself, who are human beings, are mortal. You want to have a founding team of complementary skill sets, and so you want to have at least one super strong technologist, quite possibly more than one. Some of the best startups are actually more than one founding technologist, and then it often helps to have somebody who's like a product or who's a market or sales person or has a sort of really good understanding of business on the team. Certainly helps a lot. And so we sort of look at market, product, and team. The reality is you need all three. I would say, interestingly, if you're going to compromise as an investor, if we're going to compromise on one of those, it would actually be the product. And the reason I say that is because a great market is a lot easier to make up for with iterative product execution than a poor market. Because the problem with a poor market, a small market, is even if you do a great job on the product, there just aren't that many customers. It's hard to ever get big.
As mentioned, they run the VC firm Andreessen Horowitz, and their portfolio includes holdings in Facebook, Foursquare, GitHub, Pinterest, Twitter, and Honor Incorporated. Here we are at tip number four.
At the heart of it, there's two things that we look really, really hard for. I mean, there's kind of the surface level stuff you look for. So you look for a huge market, you look for differentiating technology, and you look for incredible people. I think in practice, I think that we collectively, and we specifically, and then we collectively, VCs, I think we spend a lot of time talking about markets and technology, and we have lots of opinions, and I'm not sure that those opinions are actually all that relevant all that often. I think probably the decision ultimately is and should be around people, as like 90% of the decision. The two things we really zero in on people are, two things. They sound simple, they end up being very difficult, courage and genius. Courage is the one we talk about a lot because it's the one that people can learn. Courage, which is to say not giving up in the face of adversity, just being absolutely determined to succeed, is something that you can like force yourself to do. It can be very painful. You can force yourself to do it. The genius part is a little bit hard to force yourself to do. Courage without genius might not get you where you need to go, but genius without courage almost certainly won't. And so we're looking for some kind of magic combination of genius and courage. One of my partners quotes Nietzsche a lot on these topics. He says it's will to power. It's people who simply will not stop. And by the way, right, there's always been this kind of thing in Silicon Valley of like, sort of this, I call it the failure fetish, right? Failure is good, right? Failure, you guys are probably all have been taught this, heard about this from a lot of people, like failure is a wonderful thing. Failure teaches you all this stuff and it's great to fail a lot. And we don't like buy any of that. We think that's all complete nonsense. We think failure sucks. We think failure is a terribly, terribly depressing thing to go through. We think success, on the other hand, is wonderful. You wouldn't think that this is something you have to actually say out loud, but we do find it to be clarifying when we point it out. And so we are strongly biased towards people who are so determined to succeed that they never give up, they never quit. And I think that is a huge part of it. And that's something we really try to look deeply for. And you know, that's the kind of thing that's not listed on a resume, right? That's something that has to be fundamentally deep in somebody's character, and you have to see it in their backgrounds.
One of Andreessen's best investments was on September 1st, 2009, they took a majority stake in Skype for $2.75 billion, which was considered very risky at the time. And then simply just basically 2 years later, less than 2 years later, so May 2011, Microsoft bought Skype for $8.5 billion. So they bought it for $2.7 billion, and then less than 2 years later sold it for $8.5 billion. Quite the return. Here we are with tip number five.
I think our companies systematically are too weak on helping people evolve in their careers and develop new skills. And I think that same thing is true across the entire economy. And you almost can't be too good at it. The classic example in the Valley right now is everybody needs iOS programmers. And so everybody's out trying to recruit the same. It feels like there's only 3,000 like iOS programmers in the Valley, and everybody's trying to recruit them all. It's like, well, in a lot of these companies, you've got Java programmers, and you've got PHP programmers, and you've got web programmers. It's like, take 4 months, and there's a training company we work with called Big Nerd Ranch. They're spectacular. They literally are like, it's Big Nerd Ranch. It's like, well, you send people off, and they train them on how to be iOS programmers at the Big Nerd Ranch. Everybody's writing that down. He's pointing to somebody who's been there. Train people up on how to do these things. We have another company called Udacity that does this kind of training now online and is rolling out all these tracks to be able to train people how to do mobile development or how to train people how to do data science. I think that the development, career path, skills training is going to be such a more fundamental part of how the economy works. And I think it has to be.
When Andreessen was at Netscape, he was still a programmer. He's a coder, right? And so a lot of times, this is what an employee said about him, a teammate said. A lot of times people were there. The teammate said that Andreessen would be there for 48 hours just coding straight. Now, that's not my cup of tea, and I don't recommend that. As you know, I recommend the 20-20-20 rule, that we all work best in 20-minute segments to take that one-minute break. But I also understand that hard work works. And so I was like, work smart. But this is another instance where these top leaders, you know, there's no luck on why they became who they are. It's basically through hard work. All right, here we go with tip number six.
Cities have always played this magical role in how kind of civilization develops, and it's kind of that if anybody who, like I did, if you grew up in the country and moved to the city, you kind of see this really clearly, which is like the big difference between growing up in the country and growing up in the city is in the city you've got all these people kind of slamming together. Right, and you've got all these things that happen when people slam together, including things that people don't like. But you get ideas combining, right? And you get teams forming, and you literally get increases in productivity growth, economic growth. You get new idea formation, and it's really where, right? it's where art comes from, it's where culture comes from, it's where fashion comes from, it's where technology comes from, is getting people together. And so this idea, kind of my single biggest idea is that the internet will be that. The internet will be a city. And the internet will be the place where everybody can come together and everybody can combine. And then you combine that with my other kind of favorite idea, which I call Software Eats the World, which is basically over the next 20 years, many different fields of human activity and business and culture and creativity are going to go from being not software to being software, right? And actually, it's happening literally like right now in transportation is a great example, right? The car, the car 40 years ago was a mechanical device with a battery. The car today, has like 200 microprocessors in it, and is computer controlled, throughout the whole thing. And the car in 5 years you're not going to drive because it's going to drive itself. And so the car becomes a rolling computer, right? It's got many of the same components increasingly as a laptop computer. And the software complexity in the thing just explodes, and then it can drive itself. And then, by the way, self-driving car, you can then recreate the entire idea of what a car is, right? You can completely change the whole idea of a car, and you can completely change the whole idea of what it means to travel. Right, and so, and it's a process, basically, the way I think about it, it's a process of software kind of colonizing the car and taking over the car. And I think over 20 years, I think software takes over biology, software takes over healthcare, software takes over education, which is a big basis for our Udacity investment, software takes over financial services. You kind of trip more and more things over into being code and being software. And then you get the effect that you see with software and with entrepreneurship and software, which is you get, teams, small teams a very aggressive and hungry people able to have really big impact, right, in industries that may not have changed for a very long time. A good friend of mine, Deval Ravikant, has this great line. He says, every industry, every field of human activity, every industry that we know of today, they all started as a new technology, right? The car at one point was a new technology, like the bank was new financial technology. And then at some point, like many of them, they just stopped thinking of themselves that way. And it just, you know, things just kind of stabilized, you know, or ossified, depending on how you look at
banks
it.
Banks in particular.
Yeah, they just stopped changing. But, you know, they didn't have to stop changing and they could change again. They just have to get turned back into technology. And so then you can have kind of the Silicon Valley mindset or kind of the tech software startup mindset and apply it into these other areas, you know, and many of the areas where that needs to happen are, you know, hugely, healthcare and education, right, are gigantically important, all right, and we ought to be able to, you know, there's 7 billion people on planet Earth, we ought to be able to provide everybody with a top quality education, top quality healthcare, right, at fractions of the price that, that things cost today.
Working
and
on
we're
it.
So far from that today, but we could get there if we can turn these into tech.
Last but not least, here is tip number 7.
So the single biggest piece of career advice that I've ever heard that I realized after the fact I was implementing, I didn't realize it at the time, was Scott Adams, the guy who invented Dilbert. Easy to remember who came up with this piece of advice, because how many people invented Dilbert? His big advice was, it's not about any particular skill, it's about combining skills. Right, the world is becoming an ever more complicated place. Everything is slamming together. Right, fields that used to be discrete are now combining, due in a large part to what we've been talking about. And so, it's not about any individual skill. It's about combining skills and then constantly layering in new skills. And so, like the great example is, you can be an engineer and you can be an engineering track. You can be a writer, be a professional writer. But what if you're an engineer with writing skills, right? And then you can be the engineer who can then actually articulate what engineers do, which might be helpful. Or you could be a writer, right, who understands engineering culture and you could write books about technology, right? And all of a sudden, like both of those are like highly differentiated skills. Like those are very special skills. And then what if on top of that, you threaded in knowledge of education and then you had the ability to write about technology in education and all of a sudden that's a very special thing. And then basically through the course of your life, you just keep layering in, you keep layering in more and more skills. We were actually, I'll brag on Sebastian, you know, professor turned executive turned entrepreneur, right? Is like now talk about like a magical combination of skills, right? There's no possible professor who can keep up with him in business. And there are very few business people who can keep up with him on the intellectual side of things. And so the magic is in the combination. And I suspect the world's going to get more in the direction where combinations are going to get much more valuable.
All right. I hope those tips helped you out from Mark Andreessen. I hope you're having a great day. This is Eric Qualman. Most of you know me as Equal Man. I want to give a huge thanks to you, our listeners, for listening. And also our sponsor, Audible. Audible makes it all possible, the Super You podcast, for you to listen. And if you like listening to my voice, you can listen to the new book, The Focus Project, via Audible or your other favorite book. Right now, if you want to listen to Matthew McConaughey, wow, what a voice. What a book. Green Lights. That's another one from Audible. So that's it for today's show. I hope it helped unlock and unleash the superpower that you have within all of us, within you specifically. And until next time, I want to remind everyone, it's not what we take from the world. It is what we leave behind.
7.
6.
5.
4.
3.
2.
1.
Super, 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 super.
Super you.
Oh, yeah.